The following program is recorded content created by the Truth Network.
Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Okay, welcome back. Hope you had a great Labor Day, a great Labor Day weekend. Listen fast, because we're going to talk fast. And then after our first segment, then I'm going to do something that I do every year, which is share a very personal story, a 9/11 story, as the 20th anniversary is coming up this Saturday. I was actually at Ground Zero November 9th of 2001, so I was there 2 months after it happened, spent the entire day there with firefighters, the widow of a firefighter who died that day, just something that altered the trajectory of my life. Somebody else whose life was altered in an amazing way when he became one of the youngest members of Congress in the history of Congress is Representative Madison Cawthorn, an eighth generation resident of the beautiful mountains of North Carolina and representing North Carolina's 11th congressional district. We're excited to have Madison join us today. Congressman, how are you?
Steve, it's great to be on with you, brother. I'm doing very well. You know what? As well as I'm doing, just, you know, living in Western North Carolina, there are so many problems going on in our country. It's hard not to be worried about our future.
That's exactly right. And by the way, only believe about half of what Hal Weatherman tells you about me. We've been friends for years, so be careful with whatever
Hal says. He tells me you're the quickest shooter in the West.
Well, we'll put that to the test. Okay. Sadly, and I'm sure you've noticed this, Congressman, it's amazing to me how quickly Afghanistan and a lot of media presences is not the story that it was a week ago. But what's been your reaction to this as a member of Congress, as a young American, somebody that cares deeply about the country? Talk to us about your reaction to Afghanistan, specifically how the administration has not handled it.
Well, my reaction is very simple. You see, we've been at war for practically my entire life. I was born in 1995, first year of Generation Z. And when you start thinking that we went to war in 2001, I mean, I know several friends who have gone to combat and died. I know several friends who have gone to the Middle East and been wounded. And I know several friends who will never be the same mentally after they've gone to combat over there. And to see the way that we have really conducted our mission withdrawal from Afghanistan, which I was in favor of withdrawing our troops, but not this way. I mean, this is basically like you ask a mechanic to fix the pistons in your car, and he just says, well, let's just put dynamite in the engine and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, he did some kind of action, but it just made things worse.
It was really the ineptitude of all of this, and that's where you have to set politics for aside. The vast majority of us were in favor of, after 20 years, pulling our troops out of Afghanistan. It was amazing how much order we could actually maintain there in league with the Afghan army and the whatever leadership was there, with only like 2,500 guys on the ground. But to not set that up and start pulling people out early was just remarkable mismanagement. Do you think that was on purpose, Madison? Do you think it's just kind of endemic of an administration under the quote-unquote leadership of Joe Biden that they just bumble everything? Or what do you think's behind that?
Well, you know what I'll tell you? As woke and as aggressive as really our as woke and as aggressive as our generals have become, really, to what makes them seem as if they are, and I don't know exactly what to say, but as if they want to see our military weakened by all of this cultural aggressive Marxism they're really pushing. You know, I got to see the intelligence reports. They gave the administration good information. They said, if we pull out in this manner, we could see a rapid takeover from the Taliban in the Middle East. And so they knew the information. My question is exactly why did they do it so poorly? You saw generals saying, well, you know what, even if we left military vehicles over there, it's not like they would know how to actually operate our vehicles. But you know what happened? We saw that the Taliban militants were training in Pakistan, trying to learn how to actually fly, and this is alleged of what's being reported from several sources, is that they were then training in Pakistan to learn to fly our Black Hawk helicopters. That's why within 3 days of them having ownership of our Black Hawk helicopters, they were then able to already outfit and be able to fly those for what seemed like a mission critical availability, to be so skilled at flying those Blackhawks. It makes you wonder, well, how did they know to start training for that? How did they know they were going to get these Blackhawk helicopters? It seems intentional.
Yeah, and then you look at the who's going to benefit if we're going to play a, just a decent detective role. Who's going to benefit? China's going to benefit. Russia's going to benefit. Iran's going to benefit. It's just shocking. And the concerning thing is, Madison, is that more reverberations of this long history of these strange and profitable relationship that the Biden family has with China?
No, that is an incredibly well-placed point because, you know, what's going on with the Chinese government? You see that, of course, there are some risks that come from the Taliban having a terrorist safe haven in the Middle East. But you know what? I don't think that really any American is afraid of them actually conquering the North American continent.
Sure.
Or conquering America. But what I will tell you we are incredibly afraid of is the actual fact that now we have ceded almost all control of the rare earth minerals in Afghanistan to China, to where they'll have a virtual monopoly on the telecommunications market. And make no mistake, although brave men and women still have to go into combat, if you want to actually be able to fight in today's society, in today's war, you have got to have the most high-tech telecommunications systems there are. And right now, we are losing those that telecom race to the Taliban and to China.
Yeah, there's estimated to be at least $1 trillion worth of lithium there in Afghanistan, and China's all over that. I don't know if you saw the report today, Congressman. The leaked email, State Department purposefully obstructing private rescue flights trying to get U.S. citizens and allies out of Afghanistan. I have a couple of friends. One's been able to call into the show that have been involved with that. Unfortunately, that doesn't surprise me with this State Department. What's your reaction to them trying to do that?
Well, again, just exactly what you said. It doesn't surprise me, but and that's just because we've seen the ineptitude and just how really malevolent seems the Biden administration. I even hate calling it the Biden administration because it's so clear he's not really making a decision.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you start seeing that, the surprise that, you know, Americans are not allowing other Americans to go in and save innocent civilian Americans in another foreign hostile country is just remarkable. And I don't really think that can be overstated, and I don't think we're really just pressing the point too much, because I'll tell you right now, when we have Americans who are willing to put their lives on the line, and when they're not even being protected by any form of air support,
yeah,
when they are willing to go into the Middle East to actually save our fellow countrymen, and then our administration is blocking it, you know, my question is, who the hell do you owe your loyalty, Joe Biden? Because right now it does not appear that you owe your loyalty to the Americans whatsoever.
We're about to run out of time, Congressman, but real quick, don't we need to seriously consider the 25th Amendment at this point with President Biden?
Absolutely. So my office and I, we've been the first to actually formally call for the 25th Amendment to be invoked. And now I know what a lot of you are thinking if you're familiar with the 25th Amendment. It means that it's very clear the president is incapable physically and mentally to discharge the duties of his office. That means Kamala would be president. But let me tell you, if we don't start holding people accountable, they'll keep going.
That's right. That's just going to keep getting worse. That's right. Representative Madison Cawthorn, thank you for your efforts. God bless you, brother. We'll talk to you again real soon.
An honor. See you, brother.
All right.
Bye.
All right, man. We'll be right back.
There's a man going around taking names.
Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. Settle in.
And who to blame.
For the rest of the hour, because I have a story to tell you that I made a promise all the way back in 2001, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, specifically on November 9th of 2001, because I spent the day in New York City. I was at Ground Zero. I was at a fire station. I was in the family room of a new mother whose husband, Anthony, had died at Ground Zero as a Proby, brand new firefighter with the FDNY. And so I had a chance to be up there and spent the whole day up there. And at that day, Tom Denard was the firefighter who spent the day with me. And I'm going to give you the backstory. I'll unpack this whole thing for you. He gave me some T-shirts for my family. He gave me a hat that I still have. And it's got on the front some flames. And you could tell it's kind of a 9/11 theme thing. And then on the back of the hat, right where the little straps is, it says, never forget. And so at the end of the day, as he was driving me back to the train station, because my family, we were visiting my sister. They had just recently moved from Raleigh to the Philadelphia area. Actually, one of the pilots on one of the planes was from this little town, Yardley, in Philadelphia, north of Philadelphia. So we had gone to visit. So God just opened some doors. And I was able to spend the day up there, and he was taking me back to the train station. And throughout the day, because Tom spent the whole day with me, I'm just some Yahoo, right? This is before radio. This is before activism. This is before all that stuff. I'm just some Yahoo house painter guy from Raleigh. And so during the day, I felt so bad that he literally picked me up at 9, dropped me off at like 4. And I felt bad that I had taken away his whole day from him. Now, in every fire station in the New York City area in the boroughs that had lost firefighters on 9/11, 343 dead firefighters, they all took somebody kind of offline, and they would be dressed in their blues, and their job was to basically be the emissary between the station and friends and family of the fallen firefighters. So that's how I got connected with Tom. But during the day, several times I apologized to him. I'm like, listen, bro, I'm really sorry. I feel like I'm really kind of stealing your time. I'm just some yahoo from Raleigh, North Carolina. He said, no, it was really nice. But on the last drive, as we left 9/11, as we left Ground Zero, literally down in Ground Zero, okay, we're driving by the remains of 4, 5, and 6. 1 and 2 had obviously fallen. The hotel had obviously fallen. And 7 fell late in the afternoon on 9/11. He said, all right, dude. And I could tell he's a little agitated. And he goes, all right. You've said that so many times today. Let me just tell you, if we could bring every American citizen here and spend the day with them like I just did with you, we would. So quit apologizing to me for being here. It's my honor to have you. I'm glad you're here. I appreciate that you're here. I'm only going to ask one thing of you. And this guy was intense. Bodybuilder, right? Super nice, super sweet, but intense. And I said, anything, man. What is it? And he said, never forget. Whoever you see with your kids growing up, don't ever forget. Don't forget what you experienced here, and just promise me you'll continue to tell the story of what you experienced here. And I said, I will. And I promised him. And so here I am. Once again, I do this every year. And I don't have any time on the radio show the rest of the week, and I'll be in New York City on Friday and Saturday for the 20th anniversary. So I'm going to share it with you today. So let me back this up. And at the time, 9/11, that morning, I think we probably all know where we were. I was about to get in the shower. My wife, Gina, called me downstairs. I'm literally still in a towel. And she's like, "That the second tower had been hit." And then you're watching it on the TV. And just helplessness and anger and rage and concern and the Pentagon. And then Shanksville. And then one tower, then the other tower. Is a horrific day, obviously. But shortly after that, you remember, we all had this desire to do something. And one of the things that's important about telling this story for all of us that lived through it as adults is that our kids, and I see this with the children, the teenagers that I teach now, really have no recollection. They have no experience where they've seen the country almost literally united. Remember that? In the days after 9/11, for a couple of months, 2 or 3 months, literally the president had an 80%+ approval rating, President Bush, and there was this sense of patriotism, unity, brotherhood, sisterhood. I never experienced it in my life up until that point. Haven't experienced it since. But it happened. It was real. So most of us were like, what can I do to help? I got to do something. So most of us, not being able to go up there and help dig, gave money, right? Remember that? All these different little charitable things started popping up. People would stop by fire departments and police departments and drop off cookies or whatever, because you had to do something. Well, a guy that used to work for me in my house painting business had subsequently started his own. A great guy, Harry Pappas, here in the Raleigh area. And he, a former Navy SEAL. I called him on 9/11. Late morning, 11:30, 12, 1 o'clock at the latest, because I knew he still had friends that were SEALs, Navy SEALs. And I was just curious. I'm like, hey, have you talked to any of your friends? Yeah, I called a couple of them, and they were gone already. Their wives didn't know where they went, didn't know where they were coming back. Super serious. Well, obviously, and a week or two later, not that long, we were just talking, continuing a conversation. And he's like, man, do you want to do something? You feel like we need to do something? I'm like, yeah, I mean, I went by a firehouse and dropped off a check. I'm like, to who? I mean, who do I write this out to? I just dropped off a check for my business. And then we both began talking and said, you know what? Let's talk to our guys. See if our guys would, because he had a bunch of painters. I had a bunch of painters. Let's see if our guys would be willing to work for free on a couple houses. And let's talk to Sherwin Williams and see if they'll be willing to give us the paint at cost or for free. And let's raise some money, and then let's give it. Cause I dropped off a check for $500. We can do better than that. We can raise $4,000 or $5,000 easily. Piece of cake. So let's do that. And that's what we decided to do. And our guys were willing to work for free. And Sherwin Williams, I think, gave us the paint at cost. And so we did that. So all of a sudden we knew we were going to have about $4,000. But early on, God bless Bill O'Reilly. Remember this, because Bill O'Reilly, early on, literally several hundred millions of dollars were given shortly after, right? Within a month, 5 weeks, these different charities are popping up. And how do you know that this money is actually going to the people that need it? How do we know that this money is going to the widows of firefighters or police or Port Authority? What about the people on the airplanes? What about the pilots? What about, but especially the people, the first responders, because they didn't have to make the kind of money or have the kind of backup that people in the airline industry did. So that was the question. Remember that? We were all, everybody, and Bill O'Reilly was Johnny on the spot with that. It was great. That's when I kind of became a Bill O'Reilly fan. So early on, it was like, wow, well, we have the $4,000. We got to give it to somebody. How do we know we're going to give it to the right person? So I did what any smart kid did. Back in 2001, I called my dad. My dad's a very wise man, is with the Lord now, but called him, told him what was going on and what we wanted to do. And this is so my dad. Because I was raised by a kind of a consummate sales guy and manager. And he's like, call the mayor's office. Come on, Dad. Hey, it's Steve Noble, house painter extraordinaire from Raleigh, North Carolina. Is Rudy available? I need to talk to Rudy, that being Rudy Giuliani. All right, come on, Dad. I'm telling you, call the mayor's office. Tell them what you're trying to do, and odds are they'll help you. Okay, fine. So I did that. I called the mayor's office, and this was the first of many conversations that started essentially the same way. Hi, my name's Steve Noble. I own a house painting company in Raleigh, North Carolina. We have like $4,000 we want to give, and we want to give it to, and we had made a decision with our two companies, because we had a lot of Hispanic guys that we work with. We're like, we want to find a Hispanic firefighter that has at least one kid that died. And that's where we want to give the money. But we don't want to give it to a charity because we don't know that we can trust a charity. Who do we trust? And so actually the mayor's office, Rudy Giuliani's office, helped me. What happened next when we come back? Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. I hate to call this Saturday an anniversary. I mean, technically, that is what it is. This Saturday being September 11th, 2021, 20 years since that fateful day, September 11th. Beautiful day. Remember, for most of the country, just beautiful. Just a spectacular early fall day, warm and just wonderful. So we all know where we were, but as I was telling this story, me and a buddy who used to work for me, we built on house painting companies. We decided, you know, we're going to raise some money. We had $4,000. And then thank you, Bill O'Reilly. A healthy skepticism about what's happening with this money is literally tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars are flowing. So my dad suggested when I asked him, just call the mayor's office. Right. Call Rudy. Right. House painter from Raleigh on line two. So I called down there and explained to him what I was doing, who I was, where I was from, and it's money. I wanted to give it to a Hispanic firefighter with children. How do we do that? We're trying to go around the charities and give this money directly to a widow. And they actually were helpful. They're in the mayor's office. I'm sure Rudy knows all about it. Facetious. And so they're like, well, you could check the Hispanic Firefighters Association. I'm like, there's one of those? Okay. And a couple other things. And check those out. You can find them online. They have websites. And okay, great. Thanks. So then I just get online. And again, this was, you know, kind of dial-up, DSL, whatever, back in 2001. So that wasn't exactly a fast process. So there was a Hispanic Firefighters Association. I call them and leave a message and a couple other places. And I'm bouncing around for several days. And then I find one, it might have been somebody from the Hispanic Firefighters Association, that told me about this widows group. So Hispanic widows, families of widows, and I don't know if it was the Hispanic Firefighters Association. Anyway, I ended up back there, called once, and I talked to a lady there, explained again, hi, my name's Steve Noble, come from Raleigh, North Carolina, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, okay, well, that's really great. I really appreciate that. Have you considered giving it to this group or that group? I said, no, actually, I'm trying to find a way to give it actually to the widow. I don't want to give this money to a charity. I want to give it to a person. However we do that. So that's what okay, I'll look around. Now, what were you looking for? Hispanic firefighter, married with at least one child. Okay. So several days go by and she didn't call me back. And so I call again. And that's when this rather obvious New Yorker named Fran gets on the phone. All right, what are you trying to do? Classic New York. I'm like, well, this is what we're looking for. And she goes, all right, hold on a second. So it's literally she pulls the phone away from her head, right? And so she's talking. literally blasting away into the phone as she's talking to everybody in the office. Hey, there's this guy on the phone. He's trying to get money. They have a check, blah, blah, blah. A Hispanic firefighter that has kids that died. And so people start just literally throwing names out there in the background. So you can imagine I've got the phone on my shoulder and I've got a pen and a pad of paper and I'm just writing. First name I heard was Angel Warbe, J-U-A-R-B-E, Angel Warbe. I'm like, okay, there's one. Then another one. And then I heard a lady say, hey, didn't Evelyn Rodriguez just have a baby? Now, our third child, Clay, was born Valentine's Day of 2001. So I was particularly sensitive to the newborn child thing. Evelyn Rodriguez just had a baby. I'm like, since 9/11? Yep. And there was actually a big People magazine article on the babies that were born to firefighters and police officers after 9/11. And so she gets back on. She goes, did you catch any of that? I'm like, yes, ma'am. She goes, that's all I can do for you. Click, and she's gone. I'm like, great. All right, super. Anthony, Evelyn Rodriguez, husband something Rodriguez. I think she told me his name, Anthony. So I go online again. I'm trying to find out, where do you find out who's on these lists? Like, where are these people? Well, there was a list at that point of the 343 firefighters that had died on 9/11, FDNY. Now listen, last name Rodriguez, location New York City and the boroughs, fire department. So how many firefighters out of 343 that died? I don't think I knew his name. I didn't know his first name. I knew his last name. It's been 20 years. Cut me some slack. So how many of them? 5, 8, 10? There was one. One FDNY firefighter on 9/11 died with the last name Rodriguez, first name Anthony. So I'm like, okay, well, how do I find where he's at? Then you go to another website, just searching websites, like a dog with a bone. And find out, like it's like Ladder Company 131, Engine Company 231, Brooklyn. Okay. Does the FDNY have a website for itself? Well, yeah, big one. Do they have one in Brooklyn? Do they have a phone number in Brooklyn? Lo and behold, they do. So I call the Brooklyn FDNY. Once again, hi, this is Steve Noble, calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. I own a house painting company. We have $4,000. We're trying to give it. We actually want to give it to Anthony Rodriguez's wife, Evelyn. He died on 9/11. He was an engine company. I think it was 131 ladder, 261, something like that. So he goes, nice guy, FDNY guy. He goes, we're not allowed to give out the inside phone numbers of individual firehouses. That's not public information. My dad, who I mentioned earlier, also told me in negotiations, whoever talks first loses. So I didn't say anything. I just waited, one of those pregnant pauses. And the guy goes, I'm going to give it to you anyway. Awesome. Touchdown. So he gives me the phone number. Okay, man, thanks, bro. Appreciate it. Click. Pick up the phone. Remember those days? Pick up the phone, and I call the number. Firehouse. Hi, my name is Steve Noble. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. We have $4,000. We're trying to give it to Evelyn Rodriguez directly. Hold on a second. You need to talk to an officer. Okay. Can I talk to an officer? There isn't one here right now. Call back at about 6 o'clock. Okay, cool. Remember, this is New York. I'll call back at 6 o'clock. Who should I ask for? We don't actually know what captain's going to be here because we lost so many on 9/11. So just ask for the officer in charge and I'll leave a note. Okay. Thanks, bro. Bye. Click. Right. So is this going to work? Right. What would you be thinking? I was like, this is ridiculous. Really? Okay, fine. 6 o'clock, 6:05. I'll give it a couple minutes. Call up there. Firehouse. Hi. I'm supposed to, I called earlier today. I was supposed to ask for the officer in charge, captain in charge. Hold on a second. Captain Ford. This guy gets on the phone. Captain Ford. Hi, Captain Ford. My name's Steve Noble. I'm calling from around. Hold on a second, dude. Are you the guy? He left a note. I was like, yes, sir. I'm the painter guy. He goes, all right, now tell me, what are you trying to do? You're trying to get the money to Evelyn or something? Yes, sir. So we have $4,000. We actually want to write the check to Evelyn. I just got to figure out a way to get it to her. But actually we're coming up to visit my sister who just moved from, I mean, the guy wanted to hear all this, who just moved from Raleigh to outside Philly. So I could actually come down there. I mean, I could bring the check. I mean, my wife bought some clothes for the baby and I have a picture and a little letter explaining how we picked her. Cause I'm sure she's going to be curious. And so I was hoping maybe I could come down there. And he goes, okay, great. Yeah. We'd love to host you. So do this. When are you coming? Tell him the day. November 9th. It goes, okay. When you get into your sister's place the night before, call back. You're going to ask for a guy named Tom Denard, D-E-N-A-U-D, and ask for Tom. I'm going to tell him what you're doing, and he'll get you taken care of. Okay? And I'm like, okay, well, why don't you just give me the address for the fire department, and I'll take the train in, and I'll just get a cab or something. It's no big deal. This is before Uber and Lyft, by the way. No, we're going to pick you up. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm literally nobody from nowhere with no credibility, nothing. I got a check, but that's it. And the guy's like, no, that's ridiculous. I'll pick you. Well, Tom's going to pick you up. Just call him the night before, give him the details. I'm like, okay. So we drive up a couple weeks later, and this was really eerie. So as we're driving up to Philadelphia from Raleigh, what city do you go through? Right, Washington, D.C. Coming up 95, we wrap around the Pentagon on 395. If you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. So you could literally see where the plane went into the Pentagon. And then we made our way up there and went to my sister. So I call that night, get Tom on the phone. Tom's like, okay, all right, I talked to Captain Ford. That's great. We're super excited you're coming. I'm going to pick you up. I'll get you everywhere you want to go. And what time do you get in? I said, I'm like, I get in at like 8:50. He's like, oh, he's some expletives. Do you know how bad the traffic is down there at about 9 a.m.? No, no, sorry, Tom. I mean, I don't have control of my schedule. So he goes, all right, here's the deal. When you come out to the 7th Avenue exit, and then just come outside, and I'm going to be in this huge white FDNY van. You won't be able to miss it. And just look for me and come out, and I'll stop, and I'll pick you up. And then okay. Sure. Sounds good. By the way, Tom, do you think there's any way that, and I was being bold at this point, why not? I said, do you think there's any way I could actually, could you like get me down to ground zero? I suppose I probably can't, but he goes, no, if you want to go there, I can get you down there. We'll just say that, you know, you're a friend of the family. I said, okay, cool. We'll do that. All right, great. See you tomorrow. Click. So the next morning I'm on the train and I hadn't been to New York City in a long time, but when you go to New York City, And you're coming in on the train, what's one of the first things you notice? It's the Twin Towers, right? It's so iconic. And there's nothing there. And so that was shocking. And then when we got into the train station, remember people posted all the pictures? They made little posters. There were like entire pieces of plywood all over the place that were just covered. Have you seen? Have you seen? Have you seen? And as I walked through the train station, where I was nervous, it was surreal. I had the check. I had some baby clothes. I had a bag with that stuff in it. I'm like, those are the days when I used to wear khakis and a button-down shirt. I look like a total dork. But I'm walking through the train station and seeing all these pictures of people. At this point, you know they're all dead. And I'm going to go to ground zero? Yeah. How am I going to handle this? What about the smell? What am I going to see? What am I going to experience? I'll tell you that when we come back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. 20 years this Saturday from 9/11. Hard to believe that. And those wounds for a lot of us were kind of reopened with all the Afghanistan stuff. But just telling you a story of really, I was just sharing on Facebook Live during the break that this is really what gave birth to the Steve Noble that you hear talking to you today, that you hear on the radio, that you see on social media, that teaches, that's done, been involved with all these different things. Call to Action started in 2004. This is all before that. This is really the spark that changed my life. In the direction of my life, the purpose of my life. It impacted not only me personally, it impacted my wife, it impacted my whole family. And this all started on 9/11. When I came out of that thing, I got to do something. So ended up there. Tom picks me up the next morning. Sure enough, pulls up the big FDNY van in the middle of 7th Avenue in an intersection. And he just stops, right? He's late. I called him. He's like, yeah, I got in an accident. Expletive. And then I'll be right there. So he pulls up, and, you know, he's this big stud FDNY guy in a big white FDNY van. And I run out there. This is so embarrassing. This is back in the day when I had khaki pants, and I had a button-down shirt that was tucked in and, like, the kind of preppy shoes, and I had the preppy coat on, and I had gold wire-rim glasses. It was just embarrassing. Anyway, I jump in, right? And then we take off. Like the whole place stopped. He goes, I could do that in any intersection in New York. FDNY could do whatever they wanted back in those days. So So we're driving, and because he had told me the night before we could get to Ground Zero, and I said, "So are we going to go to Ground Zero first, or what?" He goes, "No, we'll do that later. I'm going to show you where the firehouse is." I'm like, "Oh, okay, all right, that makes sense within context." And he goes, "What do you have in the bag?" And my wife had picked a little thing for the baby, and I have a picture of the guys in front of one of the houses they painted for free, and I have a letter explaining to Evelyn how we picked her, because she's probably going to be wondering where this check came from out of the blue. So he goes, "All right, yeah, that's cool." So he just starts telling me stories. I don't have the time. But he started telling me stories of everything he experienced. Starting that morning, he was up in Long Island surfing. And he got some number on his pager that he didn't even recognize. He called somebody else and goes, "What is this code?" And they said that they're calling every single firefighter in the New York and the boroughs in. Everybody has to go in. They didn't even know what that code meant. And he was there that night by about midnight. He was at Ground Zero. Anyway, we're driving and we cross the bridge going into Brooklyn. And he's like, "Oh, yeah. Okay. So up here, Red Hook is the name of the fire department. Red Hook's like the most violent housing project in America, blah, 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 blah. We're right down the street." And so I'm thinking we're about to exit and go to the firehouse. Okay. That's cool. I've never been to an FDNY firehouse. That'll be cool. And then we go right by the exit, what looked like an obvious exit. And I'm like, "Tom, where are we going?" "Oh, we're going to Evelyn's house." This is pre-bold Steve Noble. Okay. We're going to Evelyn's house? "Yeah, I told her you came to town and that you had something for her, that you're from North Carolina. And yeah, she's expecting us." Now, Evelyn had their baby, a little girl. She was due for a C-section on September 12th, but told the doctors, "I'm not coming in until Anthony comes home." Well, Anthony died 9/11 that morning. The last time he was seen with his company was going into the Hyatt that was at the base of one of the towers. So she had her baby, little girl with red hair, consequently, on the 14th. 9/11, 9/12, she scheduled, has the baby on the 14th. And I'm like, "Okay, Tom, I don't really know what to say. I wrote a letter to explain all this. I didn't really know I was going to meet her." And he goes, "Yeah, well, don't worry about it. Let me do the talking. It'll be fine. She's super nice." "Okay. How's she doing?" "Not so well." "Okay. Gosh. So we pull up, tiny little row house somewhere. I don't even know where we were. Tiny. And so we go up to the front door, and I'm like, "I've got a camera. I don't want to forget any of this, but that seems really, like, terrible that I would ask to take a picture. Well, what do you think I should do?" He goes, "Give me the camera." And I don't think it's terrible. And we don't want you to forget anyway. So just give me the camera. "Okay, fine." Tom's in charge. So we go up there and Evelyn answers the door. She looks horrible. She could imagine. Her husband died on 9/11. Her baby was born on 9/14. And I'm there on November 9th, right? So we walk in. Her son, Derek, was 6. Super cute, super friendly little kid. And we're sitting in there, tiny little row house. The baby's asleep on the couch, bright red hair. I'm like, "Oh, that's interesting." She's nice but quiet. Spent about an hour there, and I'm looking around. They have some of the same videos we do, Thomas the Tank Engine, all this stuff. I'm like, "Yeah, we're not that far apart, really, in how we live." So at one point, you know, I asked her what was going on with the charities and everything. She goes, "Yeah, people are assuming we're getting all kinds of money. I haven't gotten any money yet." I said, "Well, I'm glad I'm here." Now, this was 2001, okay? I wasn't super bold in my faith either, and much to my chagrin, I didn't share the gospel with anybody that day. I didn't. I showed him Jesus, but I didn't tell him about Jesus. So that was convicting, and God used that in my life later. But I said, does Derek understand anything about this? Like, what's going on with his dad?" And she said, "He knows that his dad's never coming home again. He just doesn't understand why." And you can imagine being in that place with her and the baby. And we spent an hour in there, and then Tom said, "Hey, Evelyn, do you mind if I take a picture with you and Steve and Derek and the baby?" And we do that. I have those pictures. And then we left, and then we went to the firehouse, which was quite the experience. And he kept asking me how old my kids were. And I ended up having lunch there, some of the best corn chowder I've ever had in my life. We're sitting there having corn chowder. The alarm goes off. All these firefighters, the firehouse, at least in New York, is like a big frat house, right? They had a huge TV. They probably had 300 DVDs of movies. And these are guys, they're pretty rough and tough guys. And so we're all sitting around eating, and the alarm goes off. All these guys take off. Tom doesn't move an inch. He's just sitting there eating his corn chowder. And at one point, he stops in the middle of that mayhem and looks up at me and goes, "Do you want something to drink?" "Sure, bro. You got like a Coke or something?" "Sure, yeah." So we spent a bunch of time there. He has me slide down the pole, all that stuff. Then we went to ground zero, okay? And so we get there, and there's all kinds of layers of security. Even to get a van, an FDNY van, through the tunnel, all this kind of security. And then anywhere near, within blocks of ground zero, all this security. And he said, "Don't say anything. I'm just going to let me do all the talking. I'll explain everything." And we park, and he goes, "Have you heard about the smell?" "Yeah, I have. I've got masks. You want a mask?" This is pre-COVID. "No, I don't." Because I didn't want to buffer anything. I wanted to be upset. So we start walking, and he's looking intently at all these other people, all these other firefighters and police people that were from all over the country that came to show their respects. And then we end up finally getting in there. And remember in the earliest days, right after everything happened, when they started to do some events down there, press events, Cheney and Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, they'd be down there. There's this little deck that looked literally right out over the ground zero. That's where we ended up. And so we're there, and when you get in there, the only people that are in there are friends and family. And so you're looking, I'm reading all these notes on the 2x4 railings, and they're all personal. Notes from grieving loved ones to their lost loved one. And I felt like I was on holy ground and I was invading people's space, but God had me there for a reason. And at one point, there's these private security guys show up. Tom and I are like the only ones up there. And I'm like, wow, somebody important's coming. And then a couple minutes later, I look to my right, literally 10 feet to my right, and it's Benjamin Netanyahu. And I explain that to Tom. Tom goes, "Oh, blank. He's probably not a safe guy to be around. Let's go." So we came down off of there and ended up going over to the memorial for the people on the airplanes. We went to the memorial for the firefighters and the memorial for the police. And now you're down there where their children are leaving things, like handmade birthday cards. And, "Daddy, I still miss you even though you're dead. We celebrated your birthday. I love you." Wedding pictures, favorite CDs. Literally, I felt like I was invading people's space. That's why I kept apologizing time and time again for taking Tom's time. So we wandered around down there, which was just gruesome. And as you stand and look around, all this damage to all the buildings around there, I kept saying, I can't believe so few people did so much damage. It's like 11 people did all this. It was mind-boggling. And the smell, and just, it was unbelievably quiet. They're using wrecking balls to destroy the rest of buildings 4, 5, and 6. And they were just now where the two towers were. They were just now digging down below street level, and there were fire trucks all over the place spraying water. I'm like, what's with the water? He goes, oh, they hit hot spots. I'm like, still? Yeah. And sure enough, while we were there, these huge flames, 40, 50, 60 feet tall, came flying up out of where they were digging because they hit a hot spot and the oxygen hits it and poof, up it goes. So then we spent a couple hours at ground zero, and I can see it in my mind's eyes as sure as I'm looking at this microphone, my computer, and the camera. I can see it. I can hear it. It was so quiet, so eerie, made no sense. So when we're leaving, we're driving around ground zero to make our way out back over to the west side to go back to the train station. And Tom goes, oh, this is my favorite part. You heard about the people that have been here since it started, cheering on all the workers and the rescue workers and the first responders? I said, yeah, I've seen that on the TV. He's like, they're still here. I'm like, it's 2 months later. They're still here? Yeah, not as many, but they're here. He goes, this is my favorite part. And Tom pulls his arm sleeve up, and he's like, look. And his hair is all standing up on his arm. He's got chills all up and down his arm. Big, studly firefighter. This is my favorite part. And then we're starting to pull out of that area. And there 8, 10, 12 of them, I don't know how many, and they have signs and they all stand up. You remember these days? And they're all cheering and he's honking the horn and everything. And it's just amazing. And that's when he rebuked me for apologizing and taking his time up. And that's when he said, I want you to promise me something. What, Tom? Anything. Don't ever forget and tell as many people as you can. Well, here I am telling you. And by the way, the same charge exists for all of us. Keep telling this story. Make sure your kids know this. Make sure they know that there's unity, that it's still possible. It's distant. I don't know what it would take to get us there, but it sure is a nice thought. But we should never forget this, so we tell the story. I told the story to a certain extent, and now the question is, are you telling the story? Let's make sure we do that. that we never forget. This is Steve Noble on the Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always used to say, ever forward.
Another program powered by the Truth Network.